Argentinian president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. Three other men pleaded guilty and have been sentenced for their roles in the conspiracy. Prosecutors say Duran, who owns a home on Key Biscayne, was the group's ringleader. Duran could face up to 15 years in prison. His attorney has asked that he receive leniency, saying that although the offenses happened in the U.S., Duran intended no damage to any American national interest. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
The space shuttle Discovery is heading for the International Space Station after a flawless launch last evening. NASA managers are deciding whether to fire the thrusters on the orbiting outpost briefly to avoid a close encounter with a piece of old Russian satellite. That debris is projected to come within a half mile of the space station tomorrow. The crew of the space station was moved into an emergency capsule briefly last week as a precaution when another piece of space junk whizzed close by. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Trophy Time in Champaign, with plaques and promotional products to recognize all occasions from athletic endeavors and musical moments to business achievements. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. Additional information available on the web at trophytime.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program, and my name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayn, is at the controls. It's a common practice for meat producers here in the United States to feed antibiotics to their animals, both to keep them healthy and also to increase their growth. And there is also some growing concern that these drugs given to the animals may be finding their way into the food we eat, into the environment, and that that may contribute to the rise of antibiotic resistance in bacteria. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about antibiotics in the food chain, and we have two guests joining us. By phone, we have Holly Dolliver. She is Assistant Professor of Geology and Soil Science at the Department of Plant and Earth Science at the University of Wisconsin in River Falls. Here in the studio with me is John Herman. He is Assistant Clinical Professor and Veterinary Clinical Medicine Section Head here at the U of I in the College of Vet Medicine. Both of them, glad that we can have both of them here. And, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in with questions, and the two guests will take their best shot at answering those questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to pick up the telephone, give us a call, join the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions brief so we could get in as many as possible. But, of course, callers are certainly welcome. Here in the studio with me, Professor Herman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being here. And joining us by telephone, Professor Dolliver, hello.
Hello. Great to be with you this morning.
We're glad you give us some of your time. Well, let me ask some basic questions here. Maybe I'll start with John Herman. First of all, let me ask you this question. The antibiotics that are fed to animals, and we could be talking about, I think, a wide range of animals that are raised for food, could be cows, pigs, chickens. I think it's used in aquaculture. This is not given because these animals are sick. What is the purpose of giving these antibiotics?
Two basic purposes. One is as a preventive. The other is to help growth to some degree. Mm-hmm. But the main reason is as a preventive to keep bacterial contamination down to keep the animals healthy.
So mostly it is health and not the growth promotion.
Right.
That's the order that those two things
come prophylactic in. Use of antibiotics mm-hmm. is probably the number one for the routine use of it and non-therapeutically.
And how long has this been sort of standard practice, particularly if you have large numbers of animals?
I think probably as long as antibiotics have been around. You know, penicillins came in commercially back in, the late 40s. And sulfas before that a few years. But they've been around for quite a while. They recognized a long time ago that if you kept especially pigs and poultry on low levels of oral antibiotics, they just grow faster. Their average daily gain is much much more rapid. So economically, it made sense to do so. Mm.
And these are the same drugs that are used to treat humans for human disease?
They can be. Mm-hmm. You know, there's about, 8, 10, 12 different basic classes of antibiotics, and some of them are used for growth, promotion, and prophylaxis in food animals. But, you know, you're limited by the route of administration. You can only use those antibiotics that are effective through oral use as a growth promotant. You know, it does. If the antibiotic isn't is degraded by gastric acid and metabolized by the GI tract, you obviously can't use it.
And one of the things that sort of surprised me is that how is the volume of use here. I guess no one knows exactly how much, but that it's got to be over half. Some people say well over half of the antibiotics used in the United States are used in this way by agriculture. They're not being taken by people.
Right. Yeah, I've seen estimates as low as 40%, as high as 80, 84%. The problem is no one probably really knows. FDA doesn't have any kind of requirements for manufacturers to track where their antibiotics are going. Now, that said, the bulk of those, if they're used orally as prophylactic antibiotics, are generally not the same type of antibiotics that you use for humans. Mm-hmm. Generally, okay. Although they can be, but generally not. Right.
One other question, and that is that it's my understanding that most of the antibiotics that the animal take in end up being excreted by the animal. They're a very small percentage of them actually ends up being absorbed by the animal.
I don't know if that's true or not. Most of them get metabolized and broken down into an active form. Mm-hmm. Whatever is excreted is probably not in very active form. That's why we have withdrawal times, too. You know, there's antibiotic withdrawal times for all different food animal species. And if it's a responsible producer who is following the veterinarian's recommendations on withdrawal times, and then there really shouldn't be any antibiotic residues in any of the meat or milk. The dairy industry is a great example of that. The dairy industry has been kind of the hallmark of good regulation on antibiotic residues just because, back in about, mid-80s or so, there was an article on a front page of the Wall Street Journal about sulfa in milk. And the pasteurized milk ordinance was in place long before that. And really, our residues were very, very minor, if at all. Now, they're basically zero tolerance in the dairy industry.
Okay. Well, let me turn here to Professor Oliver. You're a geologist. What is your interest in this issue?
Well, I'm actually a trained soil scientist, and my interest in this issue has primarily come from the water quality aspect. There's a substantial amount of manure that gets produced from these animal feeding operations, and the vast majority of that manure ultimately gets applied to agricultural land since it's a very important nutrient source for crop production. And our concern has been these antibiotics that end up in manure. We find that up to 90% of the dose that is given to an animal will actually end up in the manure, either as the parent compound or as a degradate. It ends up being applied to agricultural land, and then the concern is that these antibiotics are now in the environment. They can ultimately make their way into groundwater, into surface water, or some other kind of environmental fate.
Now, just to follow up on what you said, and based on what here Professor Herman said, I guess I'm interested in this issue. If some of this ends up, some of the antibiotic that's given to the animal ends up in the manure, and then I think maybe an important question might be, well, how much of it is the actual antibiotic unchanged, and how much of it might be breakdown product from the antibiotic? And then maybe a further question is, well, if it's mostly degradants, to use the word that you use, then is that really a problem? Is that as much of a problem as it would be is if the antibiotic itself just passed through the animal system and then we ended up with that unbroken down in groundwater?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And right now, it's actually a difficult thing to study because you have to put radio labeled or some kind of tracer that you can actually attached to the compound and then be able to monitor that through the animal and then ultimately out into the waste stream and our research didn't directly look at that. So most of what we've done has been once it's actually gotten out into the waste stream. But in the literature that I've taken a look at, you know, it's highly variable depending on the mode of action for the antibiotic, depending on the animal species that it's being administered to. But they do find that there is parent compound, so the original antibiotic does get excreted in either the urine or in the solid waste stream. With respect to the degradation compounds, what we're finding is that some of these are very biologically active. Even though they're not the original compound, they still do have that antimicrobial activity associated with them.
Mm-hmm. Do you? I just wonder what you think about this, particularly this really high level of pass-through of these antibiotics. Do you have reason to think maybe it's not that? I'm talking here to John Herman. Do you have reason to think that it's not that high, or is it? Would you say, just as far as you know, well, we're not sure.
Yeah, well, this is certainly out of my area of expertise. I'm not a microbiologist. I'm not a pharmacologist, but and I don't even play one. But I've seen some literature, and I'd like Dr. Dollinger to Dolliver comment on some of this. I've seen some literature that says that manure processing systems, whether it's drying and stockpiling and then land application, or if it's composting or putting in slurry store systems, have a pretty remarkable ability to break down not only antibiotics but progesterone, estrogen, and all sorts of other stuff. Has your research shown that?
Yes. In fact, we have done some stockpiling studies where we have taken raw manure. We've worked primarily with solid manure, so manure from beef operations, where we've stockpiled it and then looked at the breakdown of the parent compound over time, and we have found substantial breakdown. And then we also did a study where we looked at composting. We took various types of composting systems ranging in intensity from very minimally managed systems to very intensely managed systems. And we've also seen breakdowns, substantial breakdowns of these compounds. However, it's very compound specific. There was at least one antibiotic that we looked at, which is a sulfamethazine or a sulfonamide compound, that was very resistant to breakdown, even under a very intense composting system.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a caller here, and I want to get to you, and I want to make sure this person knows I'm not going to make them wait forever. Just maybe one other question here I want to ask John Herman. It just strikes me that if you're spending money on feeding these antibiotics to the animals and significant portions of them are just passing through the animals, that doesn't seem to me terribly efficient way of administering and to getting the effect that you want. I mean, isn't that aside from the issue of them getting in the environment or bacteria resistance, isn't that kind of a waste?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense, does it? As a veterinarian, you know, we don't have very much control over, oh, geez, I don't know, I'd have to go out on a limb. I'd say probably 90% at least of the antibiotics used in animals have no oversight by veterinarians at all. Hmm. And that's maybe an issue we could talk about down the line. And, you know, we as veterinarians generally don't use them as prophylactic agents or growth promoting. We strictly are in the game of therapy. And so from a cost-effective standpoint, we have to make sure that antibiotics, as veterinarians, that antibiotics are the drug of choice to begin with. It has to be a bacterial infection, and whether we can be selective enough and specific enough with the type of antibiotic and treat a specific bacterial pathogen with it. And so, you know, we always look at cost-effectiveness on our therapy, and I think that's a great question. You got to look at the cost-effectiveness on the prophylactic use as well.
So do you – I've got some callers I want to get to, and we can talk about this more and why this might likely be a problem. But I guess I'll just ask you flat out, do you think that we have a problem here?
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, we have an issue with antibiotics that can show up in their environment. Again, I don't know how much shows up in meat because of withdrawal times, mm-hmm. and generally antibiotic residues in meat seem to be in pretty good control. But we certainly have a problem with antimicrobial resistance among bacteria,
yeah.
And that's something that's not going to go away. We have to make some hard choices.
And let me ask Professor Dolliver, now, I'm not sure if you would be up on this research, but I have seen some studies that apparently that indicate that if you take manure and untreated without doing the things that you've said that you can do. Say, if you take manure and you spread it on a field and then you grow crops there, you grow vegetables, for example, there are some studies that have found that there are some of this material actually ends up being taken up by the vegetable.
That's correct. In fact, one of my studies looked at a sulfonamide compound and whether or not that would be uptaken by crops or plants that would be growing on land that had manure applications containing antibiotics. That is correct.
All right. I've got some callers I want to get to. Let me just introduce our guests. Joining us by telephone, Holly Dolliver. She is Assistant Professor of Geology and Soil Science in the Department of Plant and Earth Science at University of Wisconsin, River Falls. And here in the studio with me is John Herman. He is an Assistant Clinical Professor in the College of Vet Medicine. You have this very long title. Am I missing anything that's really important? Just you can tell me how you would
like. Yeah, I'm actually not a department head. I'm a section head for community health and preventive medicine.
Okay, very good. Well, callers are welcome here, and we have some. Let's go first to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Yeah.
Very interesting, because today's New York Times op-ed piece had one of the op-ed editors had a piece about a study in Louisiana found the MRSA bacteria in 40% of the meat, raw pork, in grocery stores. By an FDA, I guess they're doing a study. And as you know, MRSA is virulent if it's not killed. I mean, I think it killed my stepmother, but it's very interesting that would happen. And also the guy talked about it being in the environment due to, fecal material from this and in the ground, like your other guest is talking about. But I don't know if you've read that study. It's in today's New York Times. It's very interesting. I don't know. What are your comments on that?
This is something we definitely wanted to talk about, and maybe we should sort of take a step back here and just say that what we're talking about here is a particular kind of staph germ that is resistant to antibiotic, and that apparently it's been seen in pigs and in people who raise them in Europe, in Canada, in Iowa, Indiana, Illinois. And so not only are people getting sick because they're just living with the animals, but then there's this further question of, as you said earlier, well, we don't think that there are antibiotics in the meat, but there's this question of, is this resistant staph getting into the meat?
Yeah.
And let me get see what both – I'll start here with the guest here in the studio.
Well,
with
I'll
me,
hang up, but it's frightening.
I appreciate you.
I mean, the guy said if you – like just take your knife, cut the meat, then take the knife and touch your vegetables and forget about it. You could get this thing that could kill you. Thank you. I appreciate all your efforts. Thanks.
Yeah. This is I think the thing that really got us interested in talking about it in the first place. So what's your reaction to this?
Yeah, I read both the article yesterday, and then also Friday was his lead-in article. There's also MRSA that's transmitted between people and their companion animals too, dogs and cats, and also between horses as well. So you don't have to be a food animal to be interacting with people in MRSA. The caller brings up a good point. I as a public health veterinarian, I tell people to assume that all raw meat and, in fact, raw vegetables are probably contaminated with something. And so you better wash it, and you better be careful in your food preparation. And so I'm never going to be making a chicken salad and using the same utensils that I'm using to dice up raw chicken with eggs or vegetables or anything else. You have to go back and default to basic hygiene and food preparation. And antibiotics or no antibiotics, there's bad pathogenic bacteria everywhere. And you don't, you never take anything for granted when you're processing raw meat and vegetables and any other type of raw fruit, for example.
Is this something, the MRSA, that if it would be in the meat, would that be killed when you cook the meat?
Mm-hmm. Generally, yep. If you cook it enough, yeah.
All right. I wonder what you think about this, Professor Dolliver.
My specialty area is not as much on the bacterial side of things, so I don't have as much expertise to add to it. But one thing that I would add is they have found antibiotic-resistant genes in groundwater, so not in the meat products, but we've even found some of these genes showing up in water supplies downstream of some of these large animal operations.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Let's go on and talk with another caller here. We have someone on our line number four. They're up next. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Recently, in our local newspaper, there were a series of articles about the fecal waste and the prescription drugs, and they were saying that it is worldwide. And every ocean, every body of water they went to discover this, they found that from when, you know, someone's prescription was not used into the sewer and then out and into the environment. And then the other thing I'm curious about, maybe your guest would know, is not only animal waste, but there is a magnitude of human waste that is bred on top of the ground, and all that that means. And I wonder if they would have any comment about those things and those venues where the waste that is contaminated is everywhere. And as we the population enlarges, I mean, and more people and more animals, and it appears to me that there is some huge disaster growing. And thank you, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, it is the case that the same kind of thing, we've seen the same kind of thing that humans who take prescription drugs, over-the-counter drugs, that doesn't all get absorbed by the body either, and we excrete that, and so that ends up going with the rest of the waste. And there, I think one of the things that we've seen in, within the last year or two, maybe a little bit more, there have been studies where they've tested city tap water and have found residues of all kinds of prescription over-the-counter stuff that people have taken. So it's a bigger issue than just agriculture.
Go ahead. That's a very good point. The United States Geological Survey back in the early 2000s did a fairly comprehensive study looking at surface waters across the United States for a wide variety of compounds, pharmaceuticals. They looked at some endocrine disruptors, plastics, fertilizers, pesticides, just this very broad spectrum of compounds that we wouldn't necessarily, you know, that we don't want to be showing up in our water supplies. And they found that all across the U.S. that our surface water supplies were indeed contaminated with these compounds. Specific to antibiotics, they actually found that upwards of 50% of the waters that they tested contained one or more antibiotics. So your caller's right. This is indeed a global issue. It's widespread all across the United States, and it surely is not just an agricultural issue. It is definitely a human issue as well. I've done much less research on the biosolid side of things. But that is indeed another major source of these compounds in the environment.
Yeah. Well, just it, and here let me turn back to Professor Herman. It certainly within the past few years, if not longer, there has been increasing attention paid in the area of human medicine to antibiotic use and to encourage doctors to only prescribe them when they're really needed, try to discourage people from asking for them all the time when they're really not needed. And so there is that concern about antibiotic use in human medicine, and for the reason that we're talking about here, that overuse or careless use can contribute to resistance. And then we end up with bugs that are really bad, and we have fewer drugs to use to fight them. I guess the question is, do we need to, you know, are we having the same kind of conversation when it comes to agriculture? And do we need also to be saying the same thing that, you know, if you've got an animal that's sick, that's one thing. But to use it in such large amounts in this prophylactic manner or to increase growth, if we end up creating antibiotic resistance in our bacteria, that's going to be a big problem that's going to turn around and affect human health.
Mm-hmm.
Are we having the conversation about this that we should?
I think so. You can't see because we're on the radio, but I just gave David a copy of the Nation's Health, which is the American Public Health Association newspaper, March issue. And it details a story about how the giant supermarket chain out on the East Coast is offering free antibiotics to people, or at least planning to. And, you know, that's just nuts. It's just plain nuts.
You mean just you walk in the door and say, can I have some? And they'd say, sure, here?
They want to help people out who are maybe in financial straits and can't. Mm-hmm. So anyways, yeah, free antibiotics. And we are having a conversation on both sides of the equation, you know, the human side and the animal side. And I think if when you talk to people who are on the national antimicrobial monitoring service or the CDC interagency task force, certainly they recognize that there's two components. There's the human use and the veterinary medical use or the animal use. And most of the research has shown, I think that's safe to say, that most of the research has shown that there's more of a direct causal link between human use of antibiotics and human bacterial resistant patterns developing, mm-hmm. rather than going two or three steps down the line, using them in animals, creating a resistant bacteria in the animal, having that animal or that bacteria go through processing, survive food handling and cooking, finally causing a bacterial infection in a human, causing disease, which is not being able to be treated by antibiotics. You know, there's about seven or eight steps there. It's a lot more of a direct pathway on the human side, and certainly they're looking at it. There's and have been looking at it for the last 20 some years. And that's one of the reasons why we're really pushing the development of vaccinations. It's been very effective against strep pneumonia in humans, the antibiotic use in otitis media in children, ear infections, mm-hmm. has gone down dramatically. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has done a beautiful job of discouraging use of antibiotics routinely in ear infections. So, you know, that it's going on. That conversation is going on. It's just really difficult to come up with drop-dead research that says, yes, definitely this, you know, A, B causes C.
Yeah. There seems that there's some reason at least to be concerned with the MRSA, that here there's a case where it's in the animals and people who, because that's what they do for a living, they raise the animals, they're around the animals, they're getting it. Now, maybe the main concern would be to people who raise livestock, but that would be a vector. I don't know whether it would really be possible to get significant then person-to-person infection as a result of person exposed to animal, person gets infected, then other people get infected being exposed to that person. Now, maybe that's not a real efficient way of getting into the human population, but it seems to me that's something that should be of concern.
Sure, sure. You know, there's studies looking at that. We just proposed one. Last fall, we didn't get funded on, but we wanted to look at MRSA and people who work on swine farms and then take intranasal samples from their family members and casual acquaintances and see how much, and then also look at their pets and see how much transference we're getting and see if it is the same bug that we're getting out of the swine farm.
Right. Well, we got some other callers here. I want to get to them. We have two guests with us here in the studio. With me is John Herman. He is an assistant clinical professor in the College of Vet Medicine. He is the section head for community health and preventive medicine. And also joining us on the telephone is Holly Dolliver. She's at University of Wisconsin. She's assistant professor of geology and soil science at University of Wisconsin, River Falls. And we're talking about the issue of antibiotics and the food chain. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up, someone in Champaign County, here where we are. Line one, hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I've been touched by this personally, too, in that I have had a brother-in-law who died from MRSA, and it is very frightening. What I wanted to mention amongst, I hope you'll allow me this special pleading, Abigail Saliers spoke at the Friday Forum, and that'll be rebroadcast, possibly today, maybe next Friday on WEFT. So she brought up something that I hadn't heard before. It's called bacterial sex. Basically, I'm bringing it up because she thought it was a great concern. It you know, what we're worried about is these resistances spreading to different organisms. Turns out bacteria, as well as viral transmission, they have this bacterial linking that happens I really didn't know was that much. So the scenario, you know, as described, is that things will become inclined to be spread because of the because of this mechanism, basically, and it will so things can transfer much, much faster than I'd ever realized that they could. So unintended consequences are sort of par for the course, and it seems that as well as all the other problems reorganizing industrial processes, that we need to be very concerned about this as well. So other than giving my plug there, I just wanted to get your reaction to this, because the transfer of these patterns, I mean, basically you're not putting genes in the environment, but you're putting out things that organisms will react to, and then they will dealt the patterns. The patterns will transfer faster than we think, and who knows where that will lead. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know if you can comment on that. Professor Salyers has actually been here on the program. She's quite well known as a microbiologist. She's on the faculty here of the U of I, and we actually have talked about some of these issues before. Maybe it, you know, be time for another conversation. I don't know if there's anything, Professor Herman, that you can comment on and what the caller had to say.
No, I think I'd default to a microbiologist on that. You know, we've known for many, many, many years, decades, that bacterial resistance can transfer very rapidly between bacteria horizontally through what are called plasmids, and then also vertically through genetic modification. And that whole process is sped up dramatically by selective pressure, by using antibiotics and exposing bacteria to antibiotics. You wipe out the ones that are sensitive, and the ones that are not sensitive, the resistant ones, are the only ones that remain. So you're selecting for resistance just probably every time you use antibiotics. So the real key is getting smart about when and where we use antibiotics.
Let me ask Professor Dolliver. Now we have talked about the concern that either the antibiotics themselves or breakdown products of the antibiotics would be in the manure of the animals, and if you use that as fertilizer and don't do anything to treat it, then you can end up with that in groundwater. Has anybody looked at, or do you know about, you know, how what happens if you actually get the bacteria? Say you get something like MRSA or other resistant bacteria into the soil. What happens when they get into the soil?
Well, we have done some studies that have looked at the parent compound in soil and whether or not that changes native soil communities in terms of their biology, and we have there have been studies that have shown that you shift to a more resistant, antimicrobial resistant soil bacterial community. So there has been studies that have shown an impact on the soil communities, definitely.
So that's the bacteria that would be naturally occurring in the soil, if you then end up putting antibiotics or antibiotic breakdown products into the soil, that somehow that you can actually encourage resistance, or that's going to act on the bacteria that are actually in the soil?
Correct. So studies have shown that there is a linkage between the use or the application of manure containing antibiotics and an increase in the number of resistant species that are found in the soil. Correct.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk next with someone in Vermilion County, I presume, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder if your guest can give us some practical guidelines for handling raw meat, and does cooking destroy the antibiotics?
Well, those are good questions. We touched on that a little bit earlier, but let's do that again, Professor Herman.
Yeah, you know, I just was writing down some notes here. There's three things of concern, I think, for consumers here. One is the presence of pathogenic, disease-causing bacteria in raw food products. The other is the presence of antibiotics in raw food products. And then the third thing is the exposure to pathogenic bacteria in either your work environment or drinking water, et cetera, some environmental contamination. So on the first thing we can just talk about just basic food hygiene, you know, just the same thing everybody learned in grade school and from your parents and everything else. Keep cold things cold, hot things hot, keep everything separated. If you're dealing with raw meat, raw beef, raw pork, raw chicken, raw fish for that matter, you clean up your preparation area when you're done. Don't use the same utensils. Soap and water goes a long way in taking care of all these problems. So that's the one thing. Reduce your exposure in the first place, and then don't eat stuff rare. And then cook everything thoroughly. Get it up to that internal temperature that's recommended by dietitians and food safety experts. And as far as the antibiotics in food, most antibiotics are going to be denatured by heat. That's why most antibiotics, unless they're in dry oral form, have to be refrigerated. And so cooking generally, from all the research I've seen, will take care of the antibiotics. The third thing is the environmental or occupational exposure, and that's something I don't have an answer to. You try to wear masks, you try to wear protective clothing, basic personal hygiene, all those types of things that you can just go to protect yourself. You know, basic wash your face and hands.
And just and the same, I expect the same thing would apply because we have particularly recently had some real concerns about foodborne illness caused by things that have been around for a long time, by E. coli and by salmonella, those sorts of things. And again, proper handling and cooking, that should take care of that. Now, of course, we've also seen some issues in stuff that people eat raw, like raw salad greens, where there's some question about whether you can do, you know, do much of anything about that. But as long as it's something that you can wash thoroughly and cook properly, that should take care of the problem, yes?
It should.
Oh, I would like to add to that. In one of the studies that we conducted, we had looked at, again, at the sulfamethazine compound, and some of the research has actually shown that that compound specifically is stable even after boiling under 6 hours. You see very little decline in that compound, even in boiling water. So I think, you know, that by and large, I think we're correct that these compounds are going to degrade under normal cooking practices. But again, there are some compounds out there that do not degrade. And then again, the concern is also for those foods that we're eating mostly raw, like lettuce or carrots, where you would not normally be cooking them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go to Belgium, line 4. Hello. Let's call it there, line 4. Go ahead.
I must not be coming through very well.
No, we got you now.
In this discussion, it seems though we use the antibiotics when we try to push a lot of animals together and grow a lot of them to solve problems. And then it seems like everything, the more clustered they get together, the more chances there are of these bad things coming up. Doesn't that just apply to us also? The tighter we're packed together in cities and stuff, the tighter these animals are packed into things, instead of being in an open environment, they develop these problems?
Well, I don't know. Professor Herman?
Well, there's probably something to that, just the logistics of putting animal bodies, whether they're humans or non-human animals, together. You're at risk if the environment is not managed properly, good ventilation, keeping the environment dry, clean, you're going to build up bacteria. I've been on, I come from 30 years of working in the dairy industry as a veterinarian, and there are some 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 cow dairies that are run beautifully. They're just about immaculate. And there's also the 20 cow backyard sort of dairy that I wouldn't drink the milk, if somebody held a gun to my head. So it really is a case-by-case scenario. What you have to look at, and maybe getting a tad off the topic, is you have to look at the carbon footprint and the environmental footprint of farm operations. And I'm not real sure that size is necessarily bad from an environmental or carbon footprint standpoint. It depends on how well they're managed. I guess the question is, is it better to have one well-managed source of pollution versus potential pollution versus 10 smaller sources? I don't know that I know the answer to that. But a well-managed farm, you should be okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, but then, though, still is one of the consequences of raising a lot of animals the fact that it does create, no matter what you do, is going to foster the spreading of disease. So does that mean that no matter what you do, if you have hundreds or thousands of animals, that you're going to have to use antibiotics in this prophylactic way, and that's just a consequence of the size of the operation? Or is that you would still say, well, no, that's not necessarily true.
I'd say that's not necessarily true. And again, I have a skewed view on this because I come from the dairy industry, and there's very little antibiotics used prophylactically in the dairy industry just because of, well, once a cow starts milk and the residues are residue avoidance is so paramount that you just can't. You have to be very, very selective on which antibiotics you use and when, just because of milk production. And then on younger animals, you just don't use them very often anyways because the management is generally pretty good. Management can take care of a lot of disease problems. Again, if you keep things clean, dry, and good ventilation, you're going to be in pretty darn good shape. But that's the real key, is trying to decrease the use of antibiotics that need for them.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know, if Professor Dolliver, I know a little outside of your area. I don't know if that's anything you have feelings about.
You know, I'm probably skewed in the other direction. I've worked mostly with the beef and poultry producers, and their use of antibiotics is definitely a little bit higher. But then again, I agree with Dr. Herman in that it's really the key thing is how those operations are being managed.
Right. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580 talking about the use of antibiotics in agriculture, and is that a concern? Do they end up in the food, in the environment? Is that also particularly a concern for the growth of resistant bacteria that could pose a threat to human health? We have two guests with us joining us by phone. Holly Dolliver, she is Assistant Professor of Geology and Soil Science in the Department of Plant and Earth Science at University of Wisconsin River Falls. And here in studio with me is John Herman. He's Assistant Clinical Professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine, where he's also Section Head of Community Health and Preventive Medicine. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next up, a caller in Atlanta, Illinois, line 3. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I've got a little bit of a comment, then I've got a question. The comment is that I had a tick bite a year or so ago, and it was a deer tick, and it looked like there was a bullseye thing like Lyme disease. And the first thing when the doctor looked at it, she said, "You got MRSA." And she ran the test, and coming back the next day for sure, the MRSA was in that tick bite. She also said that a week before, a child had a mosquito bite that had MRSA. Now, obviously, that might not be caused by the carrier, might have not been those two bugs, but on the other hand, I have a lot of wounds that I get that I don't get MRSA, so I'm kind of suspicious of that. You can comment on that. And my other question is, our large animal vet says that in the way of steaks, obviously, if you have ground meat, you need to cook it through, because anything can get mixed in the ground meat to cause E. coli, or I don't know about MRSA now, but that could be the possibility also. But he said if you cook a ribeye or something like that, you can have it medium rare, that there is no potential for bacteria penetrating into the meat. It would be a surface thing rather than inside the meat. Now, from the discussion today, I'm getting that might not be true. So there's the question, and there's my comments on the mosquito and the tick, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we'll let our veterinarian take those on and see what you say.
The first thing on the meat, I don't know that I would trust rare meat. Simple as that. If it's not MRSA, if it's not E. coli, you've got potential of coccidia, like protozoans, like toxoplasmosis as well. My days of eating rare meat are over about 20, 30 years ago. On the other thing, on the insect bite and MRSA, I'm not real sure that I know the research well enough on MRSA carriage by insects. You know, we have a lot of Staph aureus and Staph intermedius and Staph epidermidis, all sorts of different Staph bacteria on our skin anyways. And I just wonder if that wasn't a deal where it was maybe on your skin and got injected in by the tick bite. There's estimates of up to 40% of people in the human population are carrying MRSA at any time in their nasal passages. So this stuff is around. It's just a matter of, you know, soap and water goes a long ways.
Okay. Well, let's go to the next caller, and that would be somebody in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What about the practice of feeding cattle corn? Was that sort of the rationale for all this antibiotics and all this sort of stuff, or not?
You know? We're considering. Why should that?
Well, no, what I'm getting at is that did it increase the practice even more?
Oh, rather than have them grass-fed?
Yeah, right.
Well, there's something to the fact that animals, the amount of pathogenic bacteria carriage varies according to diet. And so when we started grouping cattle into feedlots and feeding them a high concentrate diet rather than a high roughage diet, you certainly changed the gastrointestinal environment. There's a whole bunch of different simple sugar-type substrates that are now available as breakdown of corn. You know, the corn is basically simple sugars for the most part. It's very low in protein. And, yeah, there is an association, seemingly, between a diet and bacterial carriage. But that's a good question.
Okay,
that's
well, the other point. thing is it would seem to me is if animals been looked at, let's say, on where it's sort of natural, they're raised naturally and that versus, these feedlots and that kind of thing, it would seem to me that the chances are much greater. You said, well, if they're well managed. But the natural setting, how many actually get infected and have a problem, in these versus the other, in other words, what I'm saying is that if it wasn't given to them, how many animals would get sick or how many would be, die, whatever, you get what I'm getting at or not?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if you remember 2 years ago in Consumer Reports, of all places, they did a retail meat study. They looked at poultry and they compared conventional poultry versus organic poultry, and they just cultured the chicken that they bought at the stores. It turned out that the organic poultry had much higher carriage rates of salmonella and E. coli than the conventionally raised chickens. And so, it really does depend on your management capabilities and how careful you are about, again, clean, dry, and good ventilation.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, I guess maybe that also gets to the question, all right, supposing that we just said for an experiment, we would just, we have some kind of big livestock operation. We just say, okay, we'll just stop. We'll stop giving this prophylactic use of antibiotics. What would happen? Would it be likely that we'd lose significant numbers of animals or maybe all of them to disease?
I think that study has basically been done in Denmark since 1996 or 98. They banned subtherapeutic use of antibiotics in especially the swine industry. And what has happened is the prophylactic use of antibiotics, of course, dropped to zero in 1998, but the therapeutic use of antibiotics has gone up dramatically in the last 9 years or 11 years. And so, I think there is something to be said for you can only manage to a certain level, but when you do have animals confined, you're going to have some problems.
And I would assume, though, the therapeutic use would be less.
The therapeutic was less, but it did go up dramatically, yeah.
Okay. We have a couple of minutes here, and we have at least one more call. Let's go to Frankfort, Illinois. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi. My question is possibly a little off topic. I heard you say that there was a grocery store chain or something that was giving away antibiotics for free. I'm wondering whether antibiotics used topically, like antibacterial soap, if that's more of a problem when it comes to entering the food chain because maybe you don't rinse the soap off very well, it gets into, your mouth, gets into your digestive tract, and then hangs around there, kills bacteria, makes a little, laboratory for the bacteria to die and other bacteria to grow that was resistant. And I'm just wondering if that's more of a problem than focusing on the agricultural side. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, it seems to me that people who have raised concerns about overuse of antibiotics have also said, well, maybe putting antibiotics in all kinds of home cleaning products is maybe not a good idea. I don't know if, Professor Irmer, you have any thought about that?
I can't think of any products that have antibiotics in them. They have alcohol in them. There's antiseptics.
Antibacterials.
Right, maybe there's antibacterials, right. Antibiotics.
Yeah, yes.
And so the antibacterial soap is, 64 or 68% alcohol, and it's the alcohol that's drying out the bacteria, and that's what's killing it. It's not antibiotic. The only antibiotics we have over the counter for skin use are, bacitracin, neosporin, that kind of stuff. Whether that selects for resistant bacteria, I suppose it could. It's just how realistic it is that is contributing to our resistance problem. Mm.
We're coming down here. We have a couple minutes left. I want to turn back here to Professor Dolliver. It sounds to me, and Professor Herman can weigh in on the same question, though, that there are a lot of questions here that we don't have answers to, and that seems to me that there's there's some significant research that has yet to be done.
That's very much true. There's a lot of research that still needs to be done, especially on the environmental presence of these compounds. There's really been just a few studies that have looked at So now that we've applied antibiotics to agricultural land and the manure, exactly how much is getting into surface and groundwaters? And I think one real big area that we need to take a look at is, what can we do about it? Are there land management techniques that could help mitigate some of these risks, or are there manure management techniques that might help mitigate these risks as well? So there still is a lot of research that needs to be done.
And just to go back to something that we talked about a little earlier in the program, I think some of the research that you've been involved in and other people have done does say, yes, indeed, that various things you can do if you're going to use that manure for fertilizer and you have this concern, there are ways to process and handle it that should help, that should indeed help mitigate any potential problems.
Correct. And I still think we have a long ways to go because there's so many compounds out there that we need to take a look at. And we've even found within a class of compounds that individual, you know, compounds out of a class don't necessarily behave the same. And then we need to look at those degradation products as well and see how they behave in the environment. Are they different than their parent compound or the main compound that they came from? So there still is a lot of research to be done.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree with Dr. Dolliver more. There's so much research to be done, and a lot of it comes down to what biosecurity measures can we develop and take, you know, whether it's using antibiotics to begin with or dealing with the residues that build up in excrement and urine, whatever. We need to look at every step of the way in our production systems and in our human societies and figure out where the antibiotic resistances or antimicrobial resistance is occurring, and then take steps to mitigate that.
It seems though that there's still something that we should know more about: what antibiotics are used in agriculture, how many are being used. I mean, when you say that, well, estimates on what percentage of antibiotics are used in agriculture in the United States. Well, on the low end, it's 40%, and on the high end, it's like 80-something%, 84%. So it seems to me like we ought to have a better idea what that is.
Yeah, we should. I worked in the Senate for 14 months as a congressional science advisor, and this comes under FDA's guidance, and FDA has neither the manpower nor the money to do it. And we need to fund this. We need to have a system where the antibiotic manufacturers have to account for where the stuff goes.
And to this date, there has been some resistance, some pushback, I think, to attempts to legislate that. Yes?
The biggest lobby group in Washington, D.C. is big pharmaceutical companies, more than oil, more than energy.
All right. Professor Dolliver, any last thoughts you'd like to leave with folks?
No, I couldn't agree more with John on just that. We need to get some more funding in order to take a look at these issues. It's definitely very important that we do that.
All right. Well, leave it at that. Our guest, Holly Dolliver, she is Assistant Professor of Geology and Soil Science in the Department of Plant and Earth Science at University of Wisconsin, River Falls. Professor Dolliver, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And here
glad
in the studio with me is John Herman. He's an assistant clinical professor in the U of I College of Vet Medicine. He's a section head of community health and preventive medicine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for the program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host for that show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our monthly look at computers. We call this Computers in You, and we do it on the first Monday of the month. Your telephone calls about computers will be invited following the 1 o'clock news. Two guests will join us this month to answer our questions, both of them from the University of Illinois. Our guests will be Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick. Let's turn our attention now to commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat trading at 5.92¾, up 22¾. July 6.01¾, up 22½. Chicago May wheat 5.44¾, up 26½. July 5.57, up 26¼. May corn 3.93, up 4. And make that 3.92½, up 4. July 4.02¼, up 4. September 4.11, up 4½. December 4.21¾, up 3¾. May beans 9.09¾, make that 9.10, up 33½. July 9.07¼, up 32. August 8.91¾, up 30¼. September 8.60, up 24¼. November 8.50, up 26¼. May meal 2.86.70, up 10. May oil, 3090, up 73. In Chicago, at the Merck, livestock contracts now. April live cattle, 84.57 and a half, down 7.5. June, 81.95, down 15. March feeder cattle, 91.50, down 45. April, 91.85, down 20. April lean hog, 62.95, down 25. April crude, 46.30, up 5. The U.S.